Hey, what's up, psychos? Welcome to another episode of Take Your Pills, Psychopath, the comedy podcast that exploits mental illness for personal profit. What? Trademark. I'm your host, John F. O'Donnell, J-Fod. We have such a rad episode lined up for all of us today. I'm just going to jump right into it. I am here with Hannah Rose. Hey, Hannah.
Hey.
Thank you so much for lending us some of your time. The psychos are going to be very, very excited to hear your perspective on things, on the world of mental health. If you don't mind, up front, can you just explain to people who you are, introduce yourself and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm Hannah Rose. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner. So mostly in my role now, I am mostly dealing with medication. So I do psychiatric evaluations and then I prescribe and I adjust medication. I'm working for different settings. I work with a women's homeless shelter. I work with a men's homeless shelter for guys that have recently gotten out of prison. And I also work for a couple of community clinics as well.
Amazing. You are, okay. This is like, I don't want to flatter you, but this is like, you're doing really good, vital, crucial work, and you should feel good about that. There's so many things that people can do with their lives, unfortunately, in our culture and our society that are harmful, but you are doing all sorts of harm reduction all over the place, and I think it's really cool.
I'm trying. You know, it's exhausting sometimes, and this, especially because the system is not working with me. The system is a lot of times working against me, but it's a calling.
That's amazing. So let me ask you this. So as you said, you provide psychiatric evaluations. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit more what that involves?
Yeah. So that's when the first time that somebody comes in and talks to me. And so we talk about how they've been feeling lately, what brings them in, the different symptoms that they're having. And we kind of go, we do a review of symptoms. So we assess for depression, anxiety, issues with anger, for any psychotic features. And then we're talking about psychiatric history. We get into medical history, family psychiatric history, social history, which is kind of like how you grew up and what you're doing now, the way that your life has, your life experiences have like influenced you and your mental health. And then at the end of it, we work on a diagnosis and then I prescribe medication if it's needed.
Okay, so that's how that process works. And what sort of tools do you use to evaluate?
We have different screeners that we use, but for the most part, I'm not using them because I find that a lot of the times it's, I can just ask the questions myself and it's going to take a shorter amount of time. I don't have a lot of time with people. I have about an hour and we're getting into everything in their lives from like even before they were born, like did your mom have any complications during her pregnancy all the way up till now. So for the most part, I just have it in my head because I've done it so much and we just go from there. And if I feel like they might be minimizing or I feel like they don't have necessarily a good understanding of symptoms, then I might use the scales just to help them to get more details about what depression actually looks like, what anxiety actually looks like.
Okay. So that's that process. So you basically are kind of in a time crunch with these folks. Mm-hmm. And you have to go through a lot of information in order to kind of figure out what is going on with them in a pretty short period of time.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting because I'm doing all of this and it takes about an hour to do it fully, but a lot of times with people, I can decide what I'm going to prescribe to them like within like a couple of minutes of asking about things. It's like you have, once you know your drugs and you know people and you just have seen the same patterns over and over, you start to be able to do that really quickly. But it's still good to get the full history, especially if people are coming in with depression. You have to get a history about mania too, because if somebody has bipolar disorder and you put them on an antidepressant, then it's likely to flip them into hypomanic or a manic episode. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But mania is hard to assess for.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've had a bunch of manic episodes and I've had experiences in psych ERs where I've been evaluated and I've definitely been in a manic state, but I've maybe been held for like a 48-hour hold. But then instead of getting a bed, they'll release me because I was able to kind of trick them.
Yeah.
Or they were able to not totally, they totally could, they couldn't necessarily determine that I was like fully acutely manic.
Mm-hmm. When somebody is in a manic state or even a hypomanic state, I get that for the most part, unless they're really, really minimizing. But even in those situations, you can kind of tell that something is off. But it's more about if they're not currently in a manic state, but they might have had mania in the past. Mania is easier, but if they've had hypomania in the past, they've never really been diagnosed. They don't really know what mania is versus kind of, a lot of people think that they have bipolar disorder and they don't. And it's a common term that's used in society. People think that bipolar disorder is having mood swings or anger outbursts or not being able to regulate your emotions. And that can be part of it. But just because you have those things doesn't mean that you actually have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder, you have to have those episodes where you're having the, you know, elevated mood, the increased rate of speech, and it has to be for like a period, for days at a time, rather than just like, oh, I stay up all night one night because I couldn't sleep.
Yeah. I totally know about that because that is my diagnosis of bipolar mm-hmm. 1 disorder, mm-hmm. which all you psychos at home know because I've talked about it relentlessly. But let me ask you this. Okay, so now you can see the patterns. Sometimes you can know within minutes what is going on with somebody, what's going to be the right medication to prescribe. But and we'll get into this. We're going to have to get into like this weird kind of paradox about big pharma and about medication. And I just feel, because I feel personally, I feel both grateful and resentful about being on psychiatric meds at the same time,
yeah.
Which is a weird thing. But before we get into that, I guess you have, I want what I, something I wrote down here. Is like, what are some of the biggest challenges you have with trying to psychologically evaluate people?
I would say the biggest challenges that I have in my role right now are so much of what I am seeing are not able to be treated by medication. I'm working with a lot of people who are in poverty, and I can prescribe as much medication as I want, but that's not going to change the environment around them. And when people don't have the resources in order to create really good coping skills or get involved in hobbies or extracurricular activities, it can be really difficult for people to get better. And medication is a very small piece of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, a holistic treatment program or treatment system is really, really important.
Yeah.
I know for me, medication is part of the picture, but it's certainly only part of the picture.
Right. Yeah. And you know, sometimes medication is absolutely necessary, but medication by itself is not the same. It's not going to be enough. As like, you need to create lifestyle changes. You need to have a community of support. You need to have good coping skills. You need to be able to have the resources in order to grow. And it's hard to do that when you don't have any money.
Yeah. Yeah. And such a limited amount of resources and not necessarily maybe a support system and all of that.
Right. And a lot of the times the people that I'm working with have Medicaid or no insurance at all. And it is much more difficult to get people the help that they need or to refer them to the places that they need to go, because a lot of places do not accept Medicaid. Like if somebody needs more intensive therapy, like dialectical behavioral therapy, that's not necessarily covered by your insurance. If you need a specific kind of trauma therapy, that's not necessarily covered by your insurance. With medication, it's a lot more difficult to get certain medications approved if somebody has Medicaid versus if they have commercial insurance. So that is probably the biggest issue that I'm dealing with, is the healthcare system in America is very disjointed. And I do a lot of fighting with insurance companies on being able to get the best care for people that they can have. And America rewards you for productivity and seeing as many patients as you can. That's what you get paid for. So it's harder to give people comprehensive and holistic treatment in that model.
Yeah. Wow. It's so unfortunate and so crazy. And our healthcare system is so broken. And that is wild that on top of all of your job responsibilities and how much emotional bandwidth that takes, you also have to battle with the insurance companies to try to get the proper care for your patients.
It's so fucking annoying. And sometimes I'll put in a prior authorization and they'll still deny it. And then I have to fight with them more. And it's annoying because I know that it's what's best for my patient. I've demonstrated that it's what's best for my patient, but they're trying to cut costs and I have to just jump through more hoops, and then they might finally approve it if I fight enough.
And that's part of your job now too.
Yeah, that's part of my job.
God, that's wild. You are in the trenches. Let me ask you this, because I do you ever worry about getting it wrong, the evaluations, or not so much?
I, of course, you know, and with diagnoses, they're always working diagnoses. They can change over time. I've had people who I've started on an antidepressant. They didn't know that they had bipolar disorder. They didn't have a clear manic episode or hypomanic episode in the past. And then it kind of pushes them into mania or hypomania or makes them really, really depressed, which can sometimes happen with antidepressants too. And so I'm always monitoring for that, and I'm always with medication. Even if I think that a medication is going to work really well for somebody, not necessarily. Medication, especially psychiatric medication, is still a lot of an art more than it is a science. And when you're, a lot of it is trial and error. And so whenever we're going through multiple medication trials in order to find the right one, it can be frustrating. And I worry. I'm like, is this the best treatment for them? If we tried a different drug, would that be the drug that works really well for them? And we just haven't tried that one yet. And so sometimes it's hard to know what is going to be the most effective for people. And it takes a little while to figure that out too.
Yeah, it is really a trial and error thing. And it's so interesting. It is more of an art, because they don't really necessarily know the mechanism in the medication that is working, how it's interacting with the brain per se. It's almost just like anecdotal evidence that it does work,
right?
Which used to bother me so much. It used to bother me so much, being like, and I would always frame it as though I was like a guinea pig for these drugs. But I've turned a corner on that, where I'm kind of like, okay, if it works, it works,
right?
But it took me so long to get there for whatever reason. I've had such resentment about having to take medication for so many years.
Well, and with medication comes side effects. And I think that that's the biggest part of it, or that's a really big part of it, is that for one, it's hard for people to accept and embrace the concept of that you might have to be on medication for the rest of your life. And I think that it's also hard because when we're trying out all these different medications, they can come along with side effects that make your life really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And people don't want to have to go through all of that misery just to find something that works. But I try to tell people, once we find something, it's going to be worth it. It just might take a while to get there.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel grateful these days that the medications that I'm on, I say, if I can maintain this level of energy and creativity and beyond what I'm on, like, fine, that works for me. It really does. And interestingly, I'm on lithium, is the main medication I'm on, but I'm actually on a subtherapeutic amount of lithium.
What's your dose?
600 milligrams.
Daily?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty low.
And then I take 200 milligrams of Lamictal and 5 milligrams of Abilify.
Okay.
So that all, I guess, working together is the sort of thing where that allows me to have a subtherapeutic amount of lithium, meaning that like the lithium amounts in my blood are below the therapeutic range. And then I guess the Lamictal helps with potentially falling into depressions. And then the Abilify is just a little bit of Abilify to hopefully keep any kind of psychosis from happening.
Right. But did you have side effects when you were on higher doses of lithium?
I was pretty tired.
Yeah.
You know, I felt pretty tired, and like libido was just like low and all that sort of stuff. You know?
And also over the long term, lithium is really hard on your kidneys. It's really hard on your thyroid. So I think that by them doing as low of a dose as possible and then supplementing with other medications, then that's good. With Abilify, of course, there's the risk for metabolic syndrome with most antipsychotics, where you're at risk for increased blood pressure, increased blood sugar, weight gain, diabetes, but you're on a low dose of the Abilify too.
Yeah.
And then Lamictal, for the most part, besides like the very, very rare Stevens Johnson syndrome, which can be toxic.
Yeah.
Or, and you know, lethal.
That's a skin thing.
Yeah.
Has very low,
for the most part. Yeah. Very low side effects besides a little bit of sleepiness at the beginning.
Yeah. 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 So I feel like that's the balance that I'm on. And if I can, like, I'm coming up on almost 2 years of having an episode. And if I can just maintain and be well, like, I'm so optimistic for the next chapter of my life.
Yeah. I was wondering, whenever I was listening to your podcast with Andrea, about when the last time that you had an episode, had you had a medication change prior to that? Or was it just the stress of the pandemic that pushed you into it? Or I was wondering what led up to the last one.
Well, I think that it was, medication was the same or similar, at mm-hmm. least. Psychos, Hannah's referring to episode 23, where I was interviewing Andrea Allen, who had a recent bipolar 2 disorder diagnosis, and I have bipolar 1 disorder, and we compared and contrasted and also talked about how she helped save me during a manic episode. Really great episode, episode 23 of Take Your Pill, Psychopath, if you guys want to check it out if you haven't heard it. But anyway, what happened was, it was pandemic stress-related stuff, politics of the pandemic stress-related things, mm-hmm. and also... I kind of had like a little bit of a fuck it attitude and started like drinking.
Okay.
And then I was drinking a lot of like scotch, and then my thinking started slipping even more, and I started like smoking weed and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then it was just like bonkers.
Right.
So that was pretty much what happened there with that.
Uh-huh. I remember, so we know each other through Joffer, who is another comedian. And I remember asking Joffer, I was like, have you seen John before when he's in a manic episode? And he was like, I have. And I was like, what is it like? What does it look like? And he told me that. He was like, well, one of the big things is that he's not sober, like he usually is. And then another, he was like, the other thing is like, he really gets into Irish stuff. And so it was really funny to listen to the episode and to hear like how deep that goes. And mania is really fascinating like that. Everybody has their own flavor of mania. Of course, there's common themes, but your specific kind of mania is very unique to you.
Yeah, it is very idiosyncratic, and it has a number of aspects. One of those aspects certainly is Irishness. Uh-huh. Like I've had episodes multiple times in Ireland. It's almost like if I get too close to the motherland,
yeah.
I like it's like too much energy is there or something. Like I was in the hospital in St. Patrick's Psychiatric Hospital in Ireland
uh-huh.
back in the day, which was such a nice hospital. But anyway, but yeah, that's like it's funny because this last episode, I got obsessed with Sinead O'Connor,
uh-huh.
the Irish musician.
Yeah,
and I thought that me and her were like spiritually working together to fight against these evil forces, like of these like globalist evil forces called the World Economic Forum,
yeah.
and like led by Klaus Schwab,
yeah.
and that they were trying to like implement this terrible stuff, like, you know, like using the pandemic as a pretense to usher in all of this awful uh-huh. shit that they wanted to do.
Yeah.
But me and Sinead O'Connor were like not going to let it happen or something like that.
Fighting the good fight. I love it.
It yeah. comes from a place of like misguided, frustrated idealism.
Uh-huh.
Like that's what mania
uh-huh.
is.
Yeah.
It doesn't come from a mean spirited place. It's
right.
like trying to fix some sort of fucked up, fix some sort of problem, whether it be real or not.
And a lot of times that's what it takes in order to create change in the world, is there has to be somebody who is obsessive and persistent about it. And until you get that, it's like things kind of stay static. So.
Yeah, let's go with that. Sure.
Yeah.
That sounds good to me.
Yeah.
No, but I think you're right. But I mean, there's a ton of creativity that is involved, but it's just not sustainable in any way.
That's the problem.
You know,
and, yeah,
and
it
it's
goes
dangerous
off the rails.
And it goes off the rails mm-hmm. and it gets weird and it gets psychotic mm-hmm. and it gets uncomfortable and really is a huge setback for one's life. And then the depression that follows is equally as debilitating in different ways.
Right.
And then a person just has to find the energy and will to, pick things back up and move forward. You
yep.
know, it's a lot.
Right.
And it's definitely created setbacks in my life, both personally and professionally and things like that.
It's not glamorous.
No, it's not. It's not. But but this is funny though. So like recently, I'm in a good place mentally and I'm optimistic and staying there moving forward. Also, but I wanted to read Sinead O'Connor's memoir. I was just like, I just took a little trip with a family, and I was in the airport looking for a book, and there it is, her new memoir called Rememberings. And I'm like, I'm going to read this. And then I found it really interesting that now when I came back and I was going to talk to Joffre and other people, I had to make a disclaimer, like with Max and Joffre, yeah. where I was like, look, I'm doing okay. Everything's fine. I read a Sinead O'Connor book. I just wanted to let you guys know that, which is the most ridiculous thing to have to give. I was like, I was saying, like, I started doing smack again or something like that. You know what I mean? Where I was like, listen, I kind of fell off the rails a little bit. I read a book about Sinead O'Connor, you know? I just thought that was kind of wild and funny.
Yeah, because whenever you really know people that have mental illness, they start to use, there are red flags, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that even whenever you said that you got a Sinead O'Connor book, I was like, uh-oh.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. And the thing is, though, is that even when you are manic, you don't necessarily realize that you're manic either. So sometimes it's hard to take somebody's word for it until you see that their behavior matches their word.
Yes, that's fair. Yeah, that's totally fair. But I mean, I respect her a lot. She's a really interesting figure. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, do you know about the whole SNL thing she did in 1992?
No, I don't.
Yeah. So she was like the peak of her fame in the early 90s. And she was the musical guest on Saturday Night Live. And during her performance, she covered the Bob Marley song War. And then at the end of that, she ripped up a picture of the Pope, of John Paul II.
Uh-huh.
And everybody lost their minds.
Yeah.
She got completely excommunicated from mainstream music industry and everything like that. But the reason that she did it was to bring awareness to the fact that Irish children were being raped by priests in the Catholic Church. So she was basically bringing awareness to the pedophilia issue in the Catholic Church well more than a decade, 15 years before that became common knowledge and anything was ever done about it. So if people actually listened to her instead of pushing her out and demonizing her, thousands upon thousands of children could have been spared, you know, horrific situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of times that's what goes along with being a whistleblower, is that if you're one of the early ones, you're going to get punished for it, and they're going to try to silence you because that system has been in place for a long time and there are certain people at the top that are benefiting from it. But how fucking cool to look back and be like, yeah, but she knew and she was trying to do something and she did something about it before anybody, or not anybody, but before like it was mainstream to acknowledge that that's what was going on in the Catholic Church. So fuck yeah, Sinead O'Connor.
Yeah, she's badass. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And now she is sort of getting recognition for that. It is coming back around all these like decades later. So yeah, and like I thought we had a similar diagnosis, you know what I mean, which resonated with me, which I actually, when I read her memoir, she did not say that she was bipolar, so I think she has something else. I think she has CPTSD.
Okay, complex post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, so the type of PTSD that has emotional outbursts and stuff like that. Yeah, so she has that, and yeah, the book's really good. Once you get past the like horrific Irish upbringing, like first 70 pages, you know what I mean? Which is very interesting as well. I'm just kidding. But yeah, she took on like this special role, but now it's the sort of thing where after the fact, where I have this narrative distance, I'm so grateful that I get to be a comedian because now I can figure out how to make comedy out of this. Because it's hilarious.
Right.
The idea of me and Sinead O'Connor versus the globalists.
Right.
You know what I mean? There is a bit in there someplace. I haven't cracked the code on it yet, but I'll figure it out in due time.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah. And I love Tulsi Gabbard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Bet that you have as well.
Thank you. Yeah. I have this story about Tulsi Gabbard, how when I was manic, I like compulsively donated $1,000 to her campaign. And then I ended up getting a call from her mother, Carol Gabbard, and we talked on the phone for like 40 minutes because I knew everything about Tulsi Gabbard's campaign and everything like that. I was like, Carol, I can't believe the way the mainstream media is treating Tulsi. She's a war veteran, for God's sake. This is ridiculous. She went down to Syria on a fact-finding mission and found out that our government, the CIA, was arming all sorts of terrorist groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and al-Nusra. She then came back and introduced into Congress the Stop Arming Terrorists Act that didn't even get out of committee. Are you kidding me? And now CNN is trying to paint her as being an Assad apologist and a Putin puppet. Not cool. And then Carol was like, I know, it's crazy.
Yeah. And you had a few calls with her, right?
Yeah, we talked on the phone at least 4 times. Yeah.
I wonder if she was starting to catch on to the mania, or she was just so excited to have somebody that was as excited about her daughter as she was, that she was like, this is great. Like, he's an ally.
I truly don't know. But what I do know is, by all accounts, she is such a nice lady.
Yeah.
Such a nice, like, genuine person, you know? But it got weird because at one point I was, like, asking her if Tulsi was single and stuff like that. Just so cringe.
Yeah, the erotomania.
Yeah, 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 erotomania. Nice. Uh-huh. And then I was trying to get her to watch my stand-up comedy special and stuff like that. I sent her the promo code.
Yeah.
It was just getting, like, it was getting off the rails.
Yeah.
You know?
I wonder if she watched it.
She did. She messaged me that she watched some of it.
Okay.
Which is kind of funny. Which is kind of being like, it's not my cup of tea. You know what I mean? Which is like a nice way of saying that.
She couldn't get through it, but she really tried for you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. You know what I mean? Like you were saying, like these labels or these symptoms, these labels are kind of working diagnoses that can change.
Yes.
There's been a lot of talk lately, or papers written that I've read, about the idea of a label for a mental illness, say something out of the DSM-5, compared to looking at it as a spectrum of symptoms.
Absolutely. And I lean toward the spectrum of symptoms as well. A lot of times people don't necessarily fit into very neat boxes in the DSM-5, and people can get very fixated on what's the actual diagnosis that I have. And as far as the way that we're treating it, I'm treating based on your symptoms. If you are talking to another provider and you tell them what their diagnosis is, it can be really helpful as far as distinguishing between bipolar 1 disorder and bipolar 2 disorder, because you're telling them, you know, there's an increased risk for hospitalization, there's an increased risk for psychosis with bipolar 1 disorder. So sometimes it can be helpful. It can also be helpful for people to have a label or a name for what to put, like, for what's going on with them. I know that whenever I was first diagnosed with OCD, I mean, I was already in graduate school, and so I had diagnosed myself as well. But it was so relieving to me to be like, okay, I'm not an evil person. This is obsessive compulsive disorder. And that was really helpful for me. And so I think in that way, it can be helpful. But as far as the treatment, people can have the same exact diagnosis and be on completely different treatment regimens. And what we're doing with medication now is we're trying to target symptoms. And especially when we're adding on medications to your original medication, a lot of times that is specific to the symptoms that you are still having. So it can be very different for different people.
Yeah. Yeah. I just find that interesting that there is that sort of, like, I didn't realize how controversial, I guess, the DSM-5 is, or how much pushback there is against it.
Yeah. And I see people now it's, they have symptoms that are consistent with people who had a very chaotic childhood. They didn't have a good model of emotional regulation. They have a lot of trauma. And they're, with the DSM-5, PTSD is still pretty acute. In order to be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, you have to be having acute symptoms of PTSD, where you're having avoidance to the triggers that remind you of the trauma, or you're having nightmares or flashbacks, or you're having hypervigilance, to where you constantly feel on edge and that you need to be watching your back. But there's a lot of people who have had trauma throughout their lives, and it doesn't necessarily manifest that way. It manifests as mood dysregulation and unstable relationships. And there's not a good diagnosis for that yet, as far as the DSM-5 is concerned. So a lot of times I find myself treating people like that. And it's like, okay, you have depression, you have anxiety, but there's a lot more that's going on than that. And the DSM-5 isn't catching it yet.
Okay. Okay. That's interesting. Wasn't there some controversy over narcissistic personality disorder being in the DSM and then being taken out and then being put back in or something?
I don't remember exactly. I know that there's a lot of controversy about personality disorders in general. With the DSM-5, they got rid of the different axes. So the first axis was psychiatric illness as far as bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder. And then axis 2 was for the personality disorders. And I know that that has been removed. With borderline personality disorder, I know that that one is very controversial because there is such a stigma that's associated with it. And even in the business, you'll still hear people saying like, oh, they're so axis 2 when somebody has borderline personality disorder. And people with borderline personality disorder, which I have traits of, can be very difficult to deal with. But I know that they are wanting to rename it just because there's such a stigma associated with borderline personality disorder. And I don't know, I'd have to do more research into the narcissistic personality disorder.
I did hear that as well, that they are really strongly considering changing the name of borderline personality disorder. Mm-hmm. I interviewed my friend Jen Tisdale, who has borderline personality disorder. We did a 2-part interview. I think it's episodes 10 and 11, Psychos. And she really opened up about it. And she was really honest and vulnerable, but also she's really funny. So she was super funny.
Yeah.
And it was really cool because I have not found anything else online that has any levity surrounding borderline personality disorder.
Right. And you know, it's always coming from a place of trauma, or emotional, invalidation, to where when you were growing up, you probably tried to express your feelings whenever you were younger and they got shut down. So you have learned other ways to let your feelings out in ways that are not healthy. It's affected the ways that you relate to other people and see yourself and in relationships. And interestingly enough, borderline personality disorder often gets misdiagnosed as bipolar disorder as well, because you have that, you have the depression, you have the impulsivity, you have the agitation. It's hard to treat, and people can be, when they're coming from a place of this trauma and they've had really bad experiences with people, that comes into your relationship with the person and in your treatment as well. Because I think that with bipolar disorder, it's now recognized as something that is it's not in your control. It's not something that you can't like go to therapy and then not have bipolar disorder. And I think that with borderline personality disorder, because it's personality features, a lot of people think that that's something that you should be able to change, and that if you still have borderline personality disorder, that you're not doing enough to change it. And because of that, you're making everybody's life around you very difficult and your own life more difficult. But thankfully, borderline personality disorder is, for a long time, it was really hard to treat. Medications don't work very well. It can treat some of the symptoms, but it's not treating the underlying cause of it, which a lot of times is emotional invalidation or some kind of trauma or abuse. But dialectical behavioral therapy is really effective for borderline personality disorder. And thank God that that came about. And it's based a lot on Buddhism and learning to be mindful and kind of not let your emotions decide your actions. So thank God for that. I think that's helping to reduce stigma, is that, you know, you can get better, and it doesn't have to be something that is really difficult for you for your entire life.
Yeah, like my friend Jen is doing well. She does DBT. Mm-hmm. It is so interesting, dialectic behavioral therapy, how it really is using so much kind of Buddhist ethics of mindfulness.
It is.
Because yeah. I would go to this secular Buddhist practitioner named Josh Korda from Dharma Punks NYC. Mm-hmm. And it would be like a discussion, and then it would be a group guided meditation. And so much of the discussion is things that you see in CBT and DBT and stuff like that.
Yeah, I grew up in a religious household and community. I grew up Southern Baptist, and there was a lot of guilt and shame that went into influencing your behavior and trying to make you to be like a good person. And I always felt that it was fucking me up. From the time I was 8, I felt like I was going to hell. Like I was already worried that I was going to hell. And there's this obsession with perfection and not sinning. And so as I got older, I was looking for some sort of like spirituality that made sense to me. And Buddhism is the closest that I have gotten to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people describe Buddhism not as a religion, but more as like a proto-psychology.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know? It's a philosophy, and I think that the closer that I get to Buddhism, the more mentally healthy that I am. And I think that there are, you know, ways that we can all benefit from it that are very removed from American and Western culture as far as the way that we are raised.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I found it to be incredibly helpful. And Josh Cord is also really into neuroscience, so he would explain the same phenomena from like a neuroscience perspective and a Buddhist perspective, and it would all complement each other, mm-hmm. which I thought was incredibly fascinating and interesting. The next thing I've written down is let's talk about medication is what I wrote. But we already got into that to an extent. Let's see here. Oh, I was going to say, personally, I'm both grateful and resentful that I'm on medication. I want to kind of talk about that a little bit. I'm convinced that Big Pharma doesn't care if we live or die.
Yeah, they don't.
You know, that's, and it's like, I wish they were not the ones that were making the medication that I have to be on.
I know. Yeah, because they care more about profit than they do about people.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess that's just the way it is.
That's, unfortunately, is the way that it is right now. With medications, more generic brands being put out, that's very helpful because a lot of times the brand names can be really, really expensive for people. They're hard to get approved. But the brand name ones are newer and they generally have less side effects. But it's still fucked up because a lot of times you have to go through the generic medications and before you can even get approved for a brand name one that's newer and has less side effects. So they still want to like make sure that you're trying to suffer through the cheaper ones first before they'll give you like the more expensive ones.
That's crazy. And it works the opposite way too, as in if a medication is too cheap and can't be patented, then it'll be marginalized, like mm-hmm. lithium. Mm-hmm. I was not prescribed lithium until having bipolar disorder for 14 years. I was prescribed every mood stabilizer, every atypical antipsychotic, uh-huh. ones that they don't even use anymore, ones yeah. that came and went off the market. And the whole thinking was like, oh, these are more effective or they have less side effects than lithium. And then all these years later, the thinking has changed to being like, oh no, lithium is the gold standard of treatment.
Lithium is the gold standard of treatment for bipolar disorder, absolutely. And that's something that we talked about whenever I was in school and we continue to talk about is that lithium is really underused. It is the gold standard for bipolar disorder. It's really, really good at preventing suicide that goes along with the depression for bipolar disorder compared to the other mood stabilizers and atypical antipsychotics. The difficult thing about lithium and the reason that it's hard for me to prescribe it in the populations that I work with is there's a lot of monitoring that goes along with it. And so you have to have a patient that's okay with and that will commit to getting their labs done for it. And if people are not able to commit to that, it's really hard to prescribe it. And sometimes it's not safe to prescribe it.
Wow. Yeah, that is a complication. That sucks. But also my understanding is, yes, there is risk with kidneys over time. But my understanding is the lithium that's used now is a lot sort of cleaner and less harsh on the kidneys than lithium that was used decades ago.
Yeah, but if you have somebody on a high enough dose of lithium over decades, it's probably going to do some damage.
Yeah. Do some people have to be on really high doses of it?
Yeah, some people do. And I think that a lot of times the highest doses you see are when people are getting out of the hospital because they're doing it. They're kind of like throwing as much at you as they can to get you stable as quickly as they can. And then once you're out of the hospital, a lot of times they can start to taper other medications and like adjust your dose a little bit more to where they can lower the lithium down. But sometimes I do see people on really high levels of lithium to the point where they're like actively yeah. having tremors, but if you try anything else, then it's not going to do the job and they'll end up in the hospital. So you just got to dose them up on lithium.
Wow. So like atypical antipsychotics don't work for them.
Not for everybody.
Yeah. What is up with risperidol? Why is that on the market? It seems like such a terrible medication.
It's It's honestly, it's no worse than the other atypical antipsychotics. Abilify has a lower metabolic risk. So a lot of times Abilify is the first one that I prescribe to people. But Risperdal can be really effective for people sometimes. And I remember I had a patient who he had bipolar 1 disorder as well. And he said that as soon as he started taking lithium, it just did such a good job of really cutting through the delusions for him and separating, you know, the loose associations that can come along with delusions, where you're seeing different things and you're putting them together and thinking that they, that there's like a cause and effect where there isn't necessarily one. And for him, it was life changing, even compared to, he was on Zyprexa first. And then he said once he switched to Risperdal, that really helped him to become more stable and kind of pop those bubbles of delusion. But I remember listening to your podcast and you saying that you did not respond well to it.
Yeah, I did not respond well to it. And then you hear about the crazy lawsuit of like all of those like boys who developed breasts and stuff like that. And there's class action lawsuit because they were given Risperdal when they were like entering puberty and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a big side effect that can come along with it is the hyperprolactinemia. And so you have changes in your breasts and or you'll have like discharge from your breasts as well. Risperdal is prescribed a lot to adolescents. It's one of the only ones that's approved for like youth with autism as far as antipsychotics. So it is used a lot in young people. And that's just something that you have to, if you're prescribing it to somebody, you have to monitor for that every single month. And if you have any concerns, you have to get a prolactin level lab drawn. And if it's high, then you need to slowly get them off of it in order to get that lab normal again, because apart from the issues with like changes in your breasts and lactation from your breasts, it can also make people sterile as well.
That's wild.
Yeah.
You know,
it's heavy duty, but if that's for some people, that's the only thing that keeps them out of the hospital. And so they've decided that, the benefits outweigh the risks of it.
See, this is like what we're getting into where there's just, sometimes there's just no great answers. There's no great solutions, you know, like, another thing when there's no great solution, and we were talking about this a little bit, and, is when someone is manic and you know, they're manic and you want to get them hospitalized and you know that they only probably need a week, maybe 2 weeks in the hospital just to kind of snap the psychotic thinking to just get them back stabilized. But there's not like an ironclad mechanism to get somebody hospitalized. And then the flip side of that is like, do we want an ironclad mechanism? Because does that undermine somebody's civil rights? So it's a dicey, sticky situation. And I think about like, this is sounds so fucked up, but how lucky I got to get into the hospital so quickly last time to get the episode nipped in the bud. But the way that I got lucky was that when my psychiatrist prescribed me some medication that she that my friend Andrew went and picked up for me, I'm pretty sure one of them was Risperdal, to try to kind of break the psychotic pattern as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. But then also because she was worried that I was going to have anxiety from coming off of drinking, that she prescribed some Xanax.
Klonopin.
And then when Andrea handed me the Klonopin, I just swallowed all of it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, in my thinking at the time, it wasn't in some sort of thing to try to overdose. It was, in a way, I thought it was going to, like, somehow keep the globalists from knowing I was, like, alive or something like that.
It was going to put you under the radar somehow.
It's going to put me under the radar somehow. Uh-huh. Yeah. I don't really understand the thinking now, but, yeah, it was like a kind of like, pretending that I was dead situation. And that allowed them to call the EMTs. And then I was put in a regular hospital. I didn't have to have my stomach pumped, but I was like, but they did something to me. But I had I was put in a regular hospital that then allowed me to then get transferred when a bed opened to a psychiatric ward.
Yeah. So with an involuntary hospitalization, there's a few criteria. And somebody has to meet at least one of the criteria in order to get hospitalized. There's the well-known ones is that you have to be a danger to yourself and or a danger to others. The third one is decompensation, and that is a reason for an involuntary hospitalization, which decompensation means that you have significantly deviated from your baseline to the point where if it continues to go on, you could become a danger to yourself or you could become a danger to others just because you're the behaviors you're engaging in or your thought processes are like becoming like riskier and riskier and becoming more dangerous. The problem with decompensation is that that's a hard one. Unfortunately, that's a, or fortunately, no, usually unfortunately, that is a harder one to argue for as far as a reason for people to be hospitalized. And I had a patient recently who is, he is becoming delusional, and I tried to call like a mobile crisis outreach team, which you can do in New York, out to his house to go to assess him. And my reason, I was like, he's not a danger to himself right now. He's not a danger to others right now, but he is significantly decompensating. And if this continues to go on, he's going to lose his job. Like, this is going to really break down his life, and it's going to take a lot for him to build it back up. And they decided that that was not enough of a reason to go out. And when I used to work at the psychiatric hospital, a lot of it is in the wording that you use and if you can get the insurance company to cover or if you can get the police officer to agree that the decompensation is, if left unattended or untreated, could become a danger. They could become a danger to themselves or others. But it's hard to, it can be hard to argue for that as far as taking away people's rights. And in some ways it's good, you know, just because one person thinks that you're delusional or thinks that you're psychotic or thinks that you're decompensating doesn't mean that you are. But whenever a few people get together and it's like pretty clear that that's what's happening and then you still can't get somebody hospitalized quickly, which you know is going to be the best thing for them, it's really frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I think that one hospitalization I had some years back, someone did come and assess me. And then like the next day or something like that, like, some EMT showed up and like took me and like, and committed me into the hospital.
Yeah.
That must have been like, they must've been something that must've been how that worked with that, the decompensation.
Right. And with the patient that I'm talking about, they recommended to me, they were like, that's not enough for us to go out and even assess him right now, which is insane. But New York, you know, is really bogged down as far as money and resources. There's so many people here that a lot of time people fall through the cracks because of it. But they were like, we recommend that he agree to change his medications, he takes himself to the ER, or what about therapy for him? And I was like, he's not going to agree to change his medications right now because he doesn't think that anything is wrong. And he thinks that things are going pretty great. Like, he is very excited about these, you know, job opportunities that he thinks are about to happen for him. He's not going to take himself to the emergency room for the same reason. And therapy is not going to be enough for somebody who is in an acute manic episode.
And he's not going to go to therapy.
And he's not going to go to therapy, and it's not going to be enough.
Yeah. 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 Those are ridiculous set of kind of like demands or requests of him to do that.
I was pissed, and unfortunately what happened is that he is just off the radar now. I can't get in touch with him now. They wouldn't go out and see him. So what usually happens is somebody has to end up in the hospital or end up in jail, and then they start to get the treatment that they need, and hopefully 6 months down the road he'll be back in services.
Yeah, it's sad. It sucks. Like, that's happened to me. Like, DC has a really bad mental health system. So I ended up in and out of jail, in and out of the hospital, all sorts of stuff. It was an absolute disaster. But again, there's no great solutions here.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's mental health. It's mental illness. It's not going to be cut and dry. It's not going to be an easy thing to solve. It wouldn't be so challenging, you know, if it was.
And even if you can get people to the hospital, what happens when they get out of the hospital is a big problem that we still have. Are there systems in place? Are they being discharged to an environment to where they can actually get better? Or are they being discharged to the same environment and they're going to end up back in the same situation in a month? And because your insurance company is paying for you to be in the hospital, they want you to be in there for a short amount of time as you can be. And so a lot of people get discharged earlier than they should.
Yeah. Yeah. We're beholden to these evil fucking insurance companies that are beholden to the bottom line, and they don't care. And it's unreal. So talking about like being put out of the hospital or leaving a situation and not being put into someplace where you have like the right environment or resources, there's a number of places where you work. Okay. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about all of them. You work at community clinics in Queens. Mm-hmm. You work at a women's homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. And you work in a men's homeless shelter for men who just got out of prison. Why are there people just getting out of prison who are immediately falling into homelessness?
Because they have nowhere to go after. Either a lot of the guys that I'm working with have been in prison for a long time, usually for violent crimes or sex related crimes. A lot of times whenever they get out, there's not necessarily a family support network that's going to be like, hey, come stay with us while you're getting back on your feet. It's hard to get back on your feet when you have those charges against you, or you have those, you have that on your record. There's a lot of jobs that you can't get. And they haven't been able to really make enough money in prison to be able to come out and support themselves while they're transitioning through the period of like getting adjusted back to normal life again. And so they send them to a homeless shelter first.
Right out of prison, right to a homeless shelter.
Right out of prison, right to a homeless shelter. And it's kind of, they're using it as a halfway house, but it's a really rough environment, and it's very difficult to you cannot expect people to get better when you are not giving them the tools and the resources in order to get better, and you're not treating them like a human being. And that's one of the interesting things about working with these men, is that when I first came into it, and it still is difficult work, hearing about some of the things that they have done. And I was, you know, really worried that I wasn't going to be able to connect with them because of the violence that they've committed toward other people in the past. But I've had a few instances that have restored my humanity or my faith in humanity in those situations a little bit. I had a guy that got out, and I ask everybody, which I have their record anyway, or I can find their record anyway. I know why they were in prison, but I ask everybody, what was the incident that led to you becoming imprisoned? Because it shows how willing they are to acknowledge it, to be truthful about it, if they've shown remorse, and the changes that they've made after. And that's a big part of assessing, like, is this person stable to be out in society again? And I had one guy who was like, he's like 65 years old. He had been in prison for 30 years. And I was like, so what brought you, what was the incident that led up to you being in prison? And he was like, honestly, I raped somebody. And he was like, I grew up in a household with a lot of violence and without any compassion. A lot of times when people are sexually violent towards others, they usually are victims of sexual abuse themselves. And he was also using drugs at the time. And he was like, the drugs really brought a demon out of me that I didn't even recognize. And he was like, when I was in prison for a long time, I've had a lot of time to think. Almost everybody in my family and everybody that I knew has died now. And I didn't get to say goodbye to a lot of people. He was like, so now that I'm out, I just, for the little amount of time that I have left in the world, I just want to do whatever I can to make the world a better place. And I was like, wow. The amount of awareness and change that goes into that is really amazing. Unfortunately, that's not the common outcome of being institutionalized for many, many years, because it is a really fucked up situation. But just seeing how somebody was able to overcome that, and I thought it gave me some hope.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of times when people engage in these kinds of like crimes or these violent activities, it's really hard to see them ever being out again or ever being like safe to be in society. And sometimes they're not. Sometimes there are going to be people who are not safe to be in society. And, but it was nice to see that, okay, we can, if we are given the right circumstances and we're doing really good therapy, which this guy had while he was in prison, like people can create this horrendous things, but it doesn't mean that they are like an evil person forever, and they can still come out and have compassion and want to do good.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to hear that there can be some instances of rehabilitation mm-hmm. in our prison system, which is just so punitive and seems to be more meant to just punish than it is to rehabilitate.
Right. And I think that in his case, you know, he had good therapy in prison, but a lot of it is, it's not about because he was in prison, like in prison was rehabilitative. A lot of it was probably because he is a person that is very open to insight and to change. And he did a lot of the work himself. Usually whenever people have been in prison for a long time, it fucks them up even more.
Yeah. Yeah. So you work there.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
and then you also work at a women's homeless shelter.
Yeah.
Does that create a different set of challenges?
Yeah. With the women's homeless shelter, a lot of women are coming from situations of domestic violence. And that has landed them in the shelter. A lot of times the people that are in the women's shelter, which is true about the men's shelter as well, it's like they've never really had a stable life. They've never been set up for success. They've been in the foster care system since they were very young. Their biological parents were either had mental illness that wasn't being treated or had drug or alcohol issues that weren't being treated. And so it is a different set of challenges whenever you're working with, you know, there's definitely more sexual trauma whenever and physical abuse whenever you're working with women populations, and that can be really difficult to recover from.
Yeah. Are the community clinics, how are the resources there for these community clinics?
New York is better than a lot of other places because it is generally a more progressive state as far as what the government and what the people here think that they should contribute to the community and to like the resources that should be contributed toward mental health. But it's still not great.
Yeah.
I still a lot of times can't get people the treatment that would be best for them or the treatment that they would get if they had commercial insurance or a lot of money. And like I said, you know, when people are staying in poverty, a lot of what I see isn't, I can't treat with medication.
Yeah. There's so many aspects of it that need to be addressed that they're not going to have the resources for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And New York is such a big city too, that it can be like really overwhelming in finding resources and finding referrals to places, because there are so many of them out there. And but there are also a ton of people too. There are a lot of wait lists. So it's difficult. It's frustrating. And it starts to burn you out after a while.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to other healthcare professionals, nurses, and it's like, you have to have this like superhuman ability to do this work because people do get burnout.
Yeah.
I've heard about people getting burnout. We have a friend, Sid Casey. She's like a psych ER nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, she's like, with this particular job, she's like, I got burnout doing it.
Yeah.
So you said that you have done some self-diagnosing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, at this point in the game, it's like, I've been trained to diagnose everybody else. Of course I can diagnose myself as well. I have obsessive compulsive disorder after an Adderall bender in grad school. I have like traits of borderline personality disorder. The Buddhism has helped significantly with that, but like sometimes I can be fucking crazy. And then I also have like definitely issues with alcohol as well, to where I'm like, I'm a binge drinker. And so once I start drinking and I get into party mode, I just like want to keep going. And there's a time period where it's really fun, but especially with the meds that I'm on now, the blackout can happen pretty quickly and then it starts to become problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. You are definitely like the embodiment of work hard, party hard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's what you've seen?
Yeah. I mean, we've hung out. You know, we have a very close mutual friend in Jaffer Khan, great comedian, a great person. Uh-huh. And
love him.
And yeah, you hit it hard, dude.
I hit it
hard. You are like a rock star out there on the streets of New York.
Oh, I'm a party girl. And I think that a lot of it comes from whenever you're working with people all day, every day, you get done. And I'm just like, I need a fucking cut loose, man. And I'm looking also for that connection as well, because in my work, I'm not talking about myself. You know, I'm not able to just share my opinions freely with people. I'm doing a lot of listening. I'm trying to word things in the most therapeutic way that I possibly can. And so whenever I get out of work, I'm like, fuck it. Like I'm going out tonight. I'm going to say what I want to say. Like I'm going to do what I want to do. But yeah, it does get me into trouble.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what, so sometimes I saw one of your Instagram stories.
Uh-huh.
So psychos, Hannah will do these Instagram stories. Do you want the psychos to follow you on Instagram?
Yeah.
All right. What's your Instagram handle?
At Hannah Rose. It's HannahRosePLS at Hannah Rose, please.
Yes. And sometimes Hannah will do these like pretty in-depth stories with where she's at with her mental health or what she wants to accomplish. And she did one that I thought was really interesting. It was endearing and also kind of funny, where she was talking about how she wants to put these party girl days behind her and instead pursue all of these like mindfulness and healthful endeavors, which was pretty funny because I saw that. And then a couple days later, I saw her at a bar fair enough. It was Joffrey's birthday, but still. And she was just like, well, I got to get fucked up tonight. Yeah. And then I think you were probably blackout by the end of the night.
I was almost blackout by the end of the night. I was like, me and Joffer talked about it. I was like, okay, well, you know what? I think it's time for me to go home. And Joffer was like, I think it's time for you to go home too. And he like put me in the cab. And I was wild definitely by the end of the night. But I was like proud of myself because I didn't cause any problems. And that's when, for me, it's like the alcohol issues is a cycle to where there will be a period where I'm drinking and I'm partying and everything is fine, but then it starts to become like more problematic and I will wake up having like more anxiety about like, oh fuck, what did I say last night? Or I start to have like incidents or get kicked out of bars because I'm like, you know, smoking weed inside or something like that. And then I'm like, okay, I need to like slow myself down. I got to dial it back a notch. And New York is a hard place to not party because there's so many exciting things going on all the time. There's so many opportunities to party. There's so many people to meet. I think a lot of the partying the drinking that I do is to help with social anxiety and just to make it easier to like float around and talk to people that I don't know and navigate spaces. And I feel like it's easier to be myself essentially, which is the fucked up part of it, is that I am being myself whenever I'm drunk. Whenever I'm drinking, I feel more comfortable being myself in front of more people until I get blackout. That's not necessarily myself, but maybe it is. That's like my like early childhood trauma probably coming up. But so lately I'm getting sick of it. It's like after a while it just feels like another party. How am I growing? How am I learning? Are these even the people that I like to be around, or do I feel like I only want to be around them when I'm drinking? And I think that a lot of the things that I'm looking for when I usually will go out and drink is I want to connect with people and I want to be around people. And in New York, a lot of that is centered around drinking. In America, a lot of that is centered around binge drinking. So I have found other things lately that I can get into and I can connect with people on, to where I, one, don't need to drink, or two, where alcohol would actually be detrimental to me.
That's great. Good for you.
Yeah, man. I'm trying. I've gotten in enough trouble, and I know that when if I don't do this now, I know where it goes. Like, I've been arrested a few times for alcohol related things. Like, and so I'm like, in New York, it's actually really hard to get arrested because I can be like wild on the street, but there's going to be somebody down the street that has their dick out screaming. So the police are like not very concerned about me. But still, even for like myself and my relationships, and especially my relationships with men, I was like, I know that this is starting to happen. I'm starting to spiral. So I have to dial it back a notch. So I got into Buddhism classes again. I'm taking Spanish classes now. I'm doing Krav Maga classes so I can whoop somebody's ass on the street if I need to. And I love it. I feel like I'm growing. And I before I was feeling really stagnant. And I think COVID did that to a lot of us, where I was like, what the fuck have I done? Like, what has happened over the last few years? And it got to the point where I couldn't even distinguish like who I was and what I was doing in 2021 versus 2020 versus 2022. And so I was like, okay, I'm done with it. I'm tired of it. And I'm going to start doing my classes. I still will party every once in a while, but I'm trying to get better about putting myself in situations to where I don't feel the need to drink as much, and to where I'm with people that I feel more comfortable with, and to where I can like drink more slowly, and it's not like necessarily like a party like shots atmosphere.
New leaf that you're turning over. I think it's great.
Thank you. This isn't a new leaf. Like I said, like, this is a cycle for me.
Yeah.
I've turned this leaf over a few times. And I think that that's kind of how it is for a lot of things in life. Things are cyclical. With bipolar disorder, your episodes are cyclical. With my mental health, like, my episodes are cyclical, or I have like spikes of it. And so it's kind of, it's similar to meditation. It's like where when you start to realize that you're drifting off, then you just like bring yourself back with love. And then when you start to realize you're drifting off again, you bring yourself back with love. So this is not my first time. This is not my first leaf, and I'll probably just keep turning them over throughout my life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you're trying.
I'm trying.
Like we all are.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an incredibly interesting and appreciative perspective to hear you explain stuff from your professional life, and then also give us insight into your personal life.
Yeah. I just think that, I mean, I'm not open with my clients about all of my struggles because it's not about me, but I think that because I have experienced a lot of these things myself, it helps me to be more understanding about what people are going through. It helps me to help people problem solve because I've done a lot of the work myself and I know the things that are helpful. So I just kind of like, I think that it all comes together.
That's cool. I agree. This has been wonderful. This has been a great conversation. So insightful. It's hitting all the right notes. This is what the psychos love. I appreciate your time so much. Can you let folks know again where they can find you? Maybe your Instagram or anything else?
You can find me at Hannah Rose PLS. It is a private Instagram. I might not accept your follow request, but I will see how I feel about it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. It's so funny. I always ask people to plug stuff. And if it's a comedian, they're like this. But a nurse practitioner, it's a whole different story.
Right. You know? I'm like, I would like to keep some of my privacy and please don't creep on me.
Yes. Don't creep on Hannah. So psychos, I forgot to do the plugs up top, but that's okay. The couple things I ask for is check out my stand-up special on YouTube, The Manic Depressive Chocolate Fountain Operator. All you have to do is type my name, John F. O'Donnell, into YouTube. I just ask that you like it and leave a comment because that really helps the algorithm show it to more people. I'm super proud of the special, and I want to get as many views as we can get on it. So please check that out. Also, If you're in the New York area, every Friday night, I have a live stand-up show at Cobra Club called Live from Outer Space. That's super fun. You can check out. If you're not on my newsletter yet, do that at jfodnews.com. And finally, if you have some extra cash, feel free to join the Patreon. That really helps me out at patreon.com/jfod. This has been another episode of Take Your Pill Psychopath, the comedy podcast that exploits mental illness for personal profit. What trademark? I feel very blessed and appreciative to be here with the great Hannah Rose. Thanks again, Hannah.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I'm John F. O'Donnell, JFOD. Thanks for listening. And wherever you are, have a wonderful morning, afternoon, evening. Love you guys. Bye-bye.